We're doing good so far. It's, I had my doubts giving this class. You know, because they have a certain requirement about the amount of hours for teacher training, and I was wondering if that would be in conflict with actually the assimilation of the knowledge that I wanted to give. You know, I didn't want to just say, okay, we completed our 12 hours and just check the box and feel good. Which could happen when you have such an immense text to cover in such a short time. And that saint I was telling you about, an amazing person. That saint I was telling you about that said you practice. You know, he's lectured on one verse for 3 years. It's actually endless. You know, and that's basically what I do. You know, I have several courses where I teach spiritual texts. Of course, you'll be welcome to join if you want. I do every Sunday morning at 10, every Wednesday night at 8, and going on for 6 years. I've taught this also like that. You know, you go one text and things, but somehow or other, it's a good combination here. And I feel like we're getting some at least core basic understanding. It's not so much understanding all the facts, it's understanding the points that they're pointing to. Sometimes it's not that many things to understand, but to understand it, you have to look at it from different angles. So I'm kind of happy that we're going forward. What verse are we up to?
22.
What?
23.
20 what?
23.
23. Okay. So, you know, basically, we started that the first chapter is for those, and the instructions are more for those who have already are controlled, and they have. Therefore, when you're controlled, right, it means you're controlling all these. The mind morphs to a level of goodness, the mode of peacefulness and perception, where you can actually sit for long periods of time, which is what's required for yoga. Right? So then we began the practice. How do you come to that point? And then it described Kriya Yoga, more action-based yoga of austerities and self-study, which requires shastra representation of mantras, and a dedication to God. And then we discuss when this happens, then the kleshas. The kleshas, the underpinning psychological components that cause all the selfish thoughts, they're reduced, and that's how you can come to that platform of meditation. And we discuss many, many verses about that, what they are, how they, etc. And then we began to discuss, kind of recently, that the cause of this suffering and what ignorance means is this conjunction between the soul and the body. That's the cause. The cause is ignorance. And then it was described in terms of the seer, the one with awareness in the scene, because all this matter and all these things that are happening in the mind and the intelligence and the ahankara, the ego, it's actually inert. It's just moving by the law of karma. It's inert. So it's the seer and the seen. And now we're going to deal with samyoga, which is basically this conjunction. And it says here, this is just understanding the real nature of the powers of the possessed and of the possessor. In other words, again, same conception, that the soul is the possessor. The possessed means basically it's inert, and the possessor is alive. So the soul is alive, and the body and the mind is just material. It's just moving according to God's laws to give you certain experiences for enjoyment or liberation. So we kind of discussed that. So the cause of this samyoga, 24, tasya hetur avidya. The cause is ignorance. When your thought process has this misconception, it just remains active in this impulses of the mind. And it doesn't produce this discrimination. So, ignorance is destroyed by knowledge or discrimination. So you have to develop this discriminatory power. And then it says that when that's done, then that's liberation. And so we're going to discuss this just a little bit more. Tadabhava, samyogabhavo, kanam, tadushe, kaivalya. By the removal of ignorance, conjunction is removed. This is the absolute freedom of the seer. So when you can remove the ignorance from the intelligence, the misconceptions, the desires that makes you think that just following the mind and the senses and that happiness is controlling the world according to your desires, when that is removed, then the seer gets freedom from that attachment and all the suffering it causes, because that's the cause of suffering, ignorance. So when you develop that understanding and that discrimination, because the cause is ignorance. So this is talking about now, it's coming to the point of liberation. How do you get free from that and the suffering it causes? Okay, so 26, viveka khyati abhiplava anopada. It says the means to liberation is uninterrupted, discriminative discernment. It's vivek, discrimination. That you, what we're doing here, we're trying to help you understand that there's a difference between your body and mind and yourself. And if you don't understand that difference, then you can never become free from suffering. You can never become free from suffering if you don't understand that difference. In other words, if you don't develop discernment and understanding and knowledge, then you won't be able to exert control over the mind to use it for that liberation. Right? Because the body is for two purposes, either for experience or for liberation. So you don't have control, you don't develop strong samskaras. And one of the ways is you hear sacred texts. Oh, it's a good idea. It becomes a good thought. I should do this. Right? I'm really not this. Right? There is a higher understanding and awareness of happiness. Right? And I should be determined to actually help get it. If you don't build those samskaras by not only understanding but the application of the knowledge and the practice of the knowledge, which is, yes, I'm not the mind and body, therefore I should meditate and I should learn in the various ways that are described to neglect this, then you won't remove the conjunction. So removing this conjunction, the means is liberation, is uninterrupted, discriminative discernment. So you're making judgment. Is that the next door again?
I didn't do it.
Damn, that embarrassed me. They really have thin walls, right? Okay, so this is so important, huh? This discriminative discernment. It comes from hearing these sacred texts, like these sacred texts, and listening to them, strengthening the contemplation of their content. I'm reading. And when you do, and what happens is, this is basically what happens. This is how you develop yourself. You listen, and you hear some good ideas according to your own frame of reference. Some of this may seem new to you, but according to who you are and being here and entering into yoga and thinking and whatever understanding you have, it may be new, but it makes sense to you. And if we'll contemplate and try to understand it and maybe apply it. You know, what a good teacher is they understand your frame of reference and they broaden it through that frame of reference. And if someone can do that and increase your perception and understanding, then naturally you become very appreciative. Because I think we inherently understand that knowledge is power. That if we can get a, that, you know, when we get an aha, this is the right thing, we understand this is a good thing because it can make me a better person and a happier person and see things clearly. Therefore, in Indian culture, it says don't go to a place that doesn't have a river, doesn't have a doctor, a city, and doesn't have a Brahmin or a teacher. Because to get the klishta, a klishta vrittis, the good thoughts that are going to help you to come in contact with yourself and make you happy, you have to have teachers. And in a proper culture, there was a class of people that all they did was perform this function. They studied sacred texts. They lived by the sacred texts. They understood the sacred texts. They had experience of the sacred texts. And then they communicated the sacred texts. But here, in modern life, it's so rare to have people that actually do that. You know, and I guess there's an attempt here in the yoga teacher training to provide a facility to that and help you in one sense to move towards becoming that a little bit yourself. In some way. So, good ideas. And so in Sanskrit it's something like this. You hear good ideas. You already have the samskar as a frame of reference to accommodate them as true. Then you take your intelligence and you try to understand them as true. Then when you apply them in your life, you will realize them as true. So, and finally, the yogi's true insight has seven ultimate stages. So now it describes, okay, by this discernment, by this practice, by this detachment, this dispassion, and this effort, you've come to achieve a level of attainment. Now, Patanjali never says what those seven stages are. Because he assumes that the audience already heard of that. And it says, what did it say? The true insight, pragya. Gya means to know. Prag means very knowing. Wisdom. Pragya. There's one verse in the Bhagavatam, the book I studied, says, Kaumara Achari Pragyo Dharman Bhagavatam Dulabham Manasanjana. Even if someone is a little child, Kaumara is between five, Kaumara Achari Pragyo, if he has some by that samskara, that wisdom. In my path, it says, Yato Bhakti or Doksaji, that he will worship Ishvara Pranidhani, worship God. Why? Dulabham Manasanjana. Even though adruvam, that we're temporary, and you know, in this room there's billions of living entities. In this philosophy, with the same soul as us. It just has a different ego during to its karma. So it may have consciousness that's delimited to the body of a man. It may have consciousness that's delimited to the body of a man, body of a woman, body of an Indian, body of an American, white, black, whatever it is. They're all the same. But it says, Dulabhan Manasan Janma Tara. But Artadam, Dulabhan Manasan, but the human form of life, Dulabhan Manasan Janma, it's very difficult to attain, it's very rare. How many human beings are in New York City compared to how many living entities? And they all have the same little soul awareness. So how rare is it to have this human form of life? But it artinam, it has value. And why does it have value? Because only in the human form of life do you have the will, the free will, the intelligence, the beauty, to actually come to actually make decisions to better your consciousness. It's always considered very rare. Sometimes the human form is considered like a great gift. And if you don't use it, you're considered a miser. What's a miser? One who has wealth but stuffs it under the mattress and never spends it. So the human form of life, so here it says the yogi's true insights. In other words, when the covering of the chitta, when the mind becomes pure, then all of a sudden you have all these insights, and basically probably there are things that sages describe. They don't even know these insights or stages, or there are different ways of looking at the same thing. But basically, you reach a certain level of attainment to liberation. And the first four are by your person left and then the right simultaneously, if that's mentioned. But to paint the liberation from action or external events. The first four, and then the last three are spontaneously arising. And, you know, the causes of suffering are completely eradicated. These causes of kleshas, they're gone, etc. But again, I'm trying to leave the things that are not the essential core understanding, which if you have an interest, you can read for yourself. You know, so I don't want to discover this. And then it describes that even when a person attains this stage, out of compassion, they can stay in the world to help others. So now we're going to enter into the first verse of, now, what's the means to accomplish this? Okay? And we had one means, which was what? It was abhyas, practice, and dispassion, right? An object of meditation. That was described much earlier in the first chapter. And I think it was 112, perhaps. And then in the beginning of 2, there was Kriya Yoga. Now it's going to be described as Asanga Yoga. An 8-step, and basically what they think is that, look at this Pantanjali, he's codifying this path of self-discipline, which is many, many different people are practicing it. Their teachers are extracting from the Vedic knowledge in different ways. They're extracting it in different ways. Now he's kind of codifying it. So they're thinking, you know, he's maybe taking common paths and combining them and putting them. But it includes, Ashtanga Yoga includes Kriya Yoga, because all the activities of Kriya Yoga, Tapa, Swadhyaya, and Ishvara Pranidhana are part of the Niyams. Niyams are the ways of controlling the mind in relation to yourself that are in Ashtanga Yoga. And practice and detachment, that's the last three stages. So this is the complete rung. And basically, it's a progression of how to control the mind and come to the highest level of awareness called samadhi. So the first step is yamas, how you control the mind in relationship to others, nonviolence, etc. And then there's niyamas. We're going to discuss all these. Niyamas, and how you control the mind in relationship with yourself. Then asana, how to make the body basically disappear from your meditation so it doesn't disturb it. pranayama, the breathing techniques, which is very connected to the mind, how to purify the mind by breathing. Then pratyahara, which is abject detachment, the senses have to be completely controlled. And then the last stages are progressive degrees of concentration. Dharana, dhyana, samadhi. And you never start at samadhi. You go dharana, dhyana, samadhi. It's like starting a car. You got to rev it up. You rev up that meditation and you can get a bit fixed on it. So, this is a very interesting verse. It says when the impurities are destroyed, right, by perhaps this Kriya Yoga and then this meditation, when the impurities are destroyed, as a result of the practice of yoga, he begins at, now he's going to give a complete round of Ashtanga Yoga. In relationship to Ashtanga Yoga, then what happens as a result? The lamp of knowledge arises. Knowledge arises. The lamp, knowledge is like light, right? When there's light, you can see things more clearly. Right? Let's say you're looking at something in a room and it's very dark. You can't make this, you can't distinguish very clearly. You can't see what's there very clearly. And all of a sudden, when there's light, you can distinguish things. That's why if you want to study, wake up early in the morning, you want to think clearly, wake up in the morning, because there's more goodness. Your mind has more light. You'll be able to smell things, taste things more clearly, hear things more clearly. Your discrimination has to do with the degree of light that's coming through your consciousness. Right? Ignorance. Absolutely no light. Person in ignorance, they lose their self-will, their control, their morality. Right? So now there's light. And when that light arises, then that discriminative discernment, that ability to distinguish becomes so crystal clear. And when that becomes so crystal clear, and you have those samskaras of I'm not this body and mind, I'm pure awareness, when you have those samskaras, those impressions in the consciousness, then you can achieve a higher state of consciousness. And we'll have what? This ultimate discernment. We'll be able to see really clearly. Well, how do you do it? What's the means of attaining it? Here it is, Ashtanga Yoga. Okay, so now he says the eight limbs are abstention, moral restraints, and observances. What regulations you have and what rules you have. There are moral regulations, rules, then posture, breath control, disengagement of the senses, concentration, meditation, and absorption. So, they're all limbs. But not, although they're progressive, that you can't begin yoga unless you follow the yama of ahimsa, it's the first thing, and without that you can't progress, and they're all progressive. It's not that you give up one and go to the other. It's like a body, it requires all the limbs. So yoga is when everything's in place. And ahimsa means nonviolence, but it means a certain maturity or perfection of nonviolence. Not that just because I'm vegetarian, I'm nonviolent, although that's a requirement in this. But you need to have a mature development of nonviolence. And it's going to be described what that is. Okay, so now, as he's done before, he mentions a verse, right? And now he's going to scholarly break it up. So now he's going to begin first with the yamas. So the yamas are what? Nonviolence, truthfulness, refrainment from stealing, celibacy, and renunciation of unnecessary possessions. So you have to have regulations if you want to control the mind. And the most important is ahimsa. Because if you can't control the mind in relationship to the exploitation of others, you can't begin any process of meditation. So, we'll discuss all these. So, controlling the mind, abstentions, okay. So ahimsa is the root of all yogas, because vrittis are ultimately selfishness. And if you can't control your selfishness in relationship to the exploitation of others, that's the grossest manifestation of selfishness. Then you can't move forward with anything else. And therefore, in one sense, all the other angas, all the other limbs here, in one sense, should be reflect the ahimsa. That I'm no longer selfish, I'm no longer exploited, I'm neglecting all these vrittis which are born out of ego. What are the vrittis born out of? Ignorance. And what is ignorance? It's selfishness. Attachments and aversion based on that. So what is ahimsa? Let's define it. He gives a definition. It's not injuring any living creature, any creature, anywhere, any time. Any creature, anywhere, anytime. And therefore, he said, it's like a elephant's footprint. Everything else has to fit in it, because you can't undertake more and more vows and austerities. Wait. It's for the purpose of purifying this. Everything you do is for the purpose of purifying, one commentator says. It's purpose of purifying this. And it makes actual sense, because everything you're trying to get rid of, actually, the pure soul, at least in my tradition, is the soul is consciousness which reaches its perfection in love. So everything that covers that is against the principle of awareness and love. And it's very clear that that nourishing one's body at the expense of the flesh of other living beings is not within the Vyayama Yoga. I mean, and in fact, I mean, again, this is very, very intense subtlety and purity of the heart. And Professor Bryant goes on and explains a sect in India called the Jains, who are the exemplars of nonviolence. You know, it's really extreme. I mean, they cut masks on their face, and they sweep the road before them, and they won't cook after dark because you can't see the bugs. So they're the ultimate exemplars of that. I'm here, it's anyway. So, anyway, inflicting violence is a quality of ignorance, and therefore that type of activity of flesh of others increases the ignorance potential of the citta, and therefore for the yogis this was non-negotiable. It was non-negotiable. And it goes further than that. Non-violence, you've got to give up the spirit of malice and hatred, since these produce the tendencies to injure others. It means no harsh words, etc. Of course, it depends on intent. You know, surgeon cuts the body, but he means to help. So, now here again with these, this is part of yoga, right? Because when the thought of criticizing someone, which is a form of violence actually, comes in your mind, right? So you're yogis, right? Because you don't act on it. The impulse is there, you're not acting on it. So this is kind of, I like this, it's kind of a nice practical example that the class can be practiced 24 hours a day. This has helped me so much. I thought I had achieved it until I put it on again. It shows you without practice, and it described what was practice. That it had three qualities, that it continues for a long time and it's uninterrupted and it's done with reverence. Without practice, the same things grow. So I thought I had achieved it and I threw the rubber band off. But now when I put the rubber band on, I realize it's just. So now the second yama is truthfulness. One's words and thoughts being in exact correspondent to the fact. In other words, whatever you know through correct knowledge, through the pramanas, through your direct experience, through your inference, from what you heard is true from hearing by those who have experience, lining your life up with that. And if you don't, if you lie and all these things again, it's tamasic, it's ignorance, it brings you again. Yoga means the mind is coming to a higher level of perception and contentment. Now I'll joke, I have to talk to the people who are listening to the class on the tape recorder. I realize that 50% of the class is in my hands. So there's a problem here, but it's so interesting. Speech is me. What do you talk for? To communicate truth to others. You talk to give knowledge to others. And then it shouldn't be devoid of value for speech. In other words, idle talk without real value of communicating something that is necessary. It's not good in terms of following this yama. Or truth, which is, or speaking, which is misleading, or deceitful. And there's a story, just to illustrate this, from the Mahabharata. There was a great warrior named Yudhisthira, and he was renowned for never telling a lie. And they wanted to break the fighting spirit of the opposing army. He was named Drona, and his son was named Ashwatthama. Some other people told him a lie that your son has died, Ashwatthama, and his spirit was broken. So he came to Yudhisthira, and he knew that Yudhisthira never told a lie. And practically, they said his feet never, he was Dhammaraj, he was the king of righteousness. And said his feet never touched the ground. But when he came to him and asked him if Ashwatthama had been killed, he said, yes, Ashwatthama has been killed. And he thought of the elephant named Ashwatthama, so he wouldn't lie. But it was deceitful. So it was still against the principle of truthfulness. Even though he kind of told the truth, but it was deceitful. So then what happened is it described that Yudhisthira's chariot, which never had touched the ground, floated to the ground. Actually, integrity and truthfulness is everything in spiritual life. Because if you're truthful and you're honest, it puts a great demand to actually live by truth. Professor Bryant, it's very interesting, he's a very, very big scholar, and he has a guru, a teacher who's 90 years old and lives in Vrindavan. And his teacher was known as one of the most renowned scholars. He had what was equivalent to 9 PhDs, if you look at it, in Nyaya logic and different subjects and different things. So when he took initiation from him, he was waiting for a big lecture to give all the significance of what is a guru and what is a disciple and all these things. And the lecture of his teacher consisted of two words. This is all he heard from his teacher. Be honest. Because now you've taken certain vows, certain responsibilities, just live up to them. The samskara of I shall tell the truth, if you get an attraction for that, the most powerful transmutatory thing in your consciousness. Because then you can say, now I will do this. And then you'll do it. Now I should practice yoga. It's good for me. I will practice yoga every day at this time. So whatever you do, you have to follow. And a proper culture would instill these samskaras when people are young. Because they would tell all you, listen, when you're young, to all the stories of righteousness and nobility. It would create samskaras when you're young. In Indian culture, for a young child, the whole culture was based on giving good samskaras. So that the child will have a klishta vrittis. He'll have thoughts that are not against yoga. The whole thing was truthfulness. And I used to meet people like this. I used to know people like this in India who had this training. It was amazing. I used to work for this one Indian man. Very fondly remember him. He was, 40 years older than me. He recently died in his 90s. And when I met him, the only thing he ate was milk from protected cows, fruit, vegetables, and yogurt. Nothing else. He never took any grains. He never took any sweetener. He never took any oil. He took never any spices. He never took any nuts. That's all he ate. And why? When he was younger, due to some circumstances that happened, he made a vow. Actually, what happened, he was in a joint family, and he was the oldest brother. Extraordinary person. Can you imagine this person? He was a master yogi. He had a PhD in Hindi, a master's in Sanskrit. He was a master artist. And he had a PhD in filmmaking, a master's in filmmaking from the University of Southern California in 1950.
Wow.
He described, he was in the, when the teacher came in, the boys and the girls are, you know, hanging on there, and he would stand up with his hands full. An extraordinary person. What happened is he, his younger brother and his son got into conflict, and to keep peace in the family, he had to sometimes side with his older brother. His only son became insulted, and his son left home. And then his wife died of heartbreak. And then he vowed, until my son comes home, I will never again come home. Until my son comes home, I will never have any sweetener, any ghee, any oil, any grains. And 40 years later, he was following. There was another saintly person in Vrindavan who was so close to me. What I do when I'm in a holy place, every day at 4 o'clock, don't announce it, don't advertise it, I come outside of my room and I read sacred texts. And I explain them. I've been doing these for years. And then some will find out and then tell another, and then it grows and grows and grows. So when I'm there, I do that. But this old man came every day. Even when he was very old. And he never wore shoes. Because somehow when he came to a holy place, he vowed, this campground is so sacred, I don't want to wear shoes. But once that's, it may be good vow or not, sick, whatever, once they make the vow, they're the postman. Rain, shine, it doesn't matter. They do it. They're true to their word. These kind of samsaras were there. But truthfulness is subservient to him, sir, not violence. Because if someone comes running, right, and says, where is that SOB? I will kill that. And then you say, do you know where he is? Yeah, I know where he is. He's over there. That's nonviolence. So you see, ahimsa is still the key. And then there's refrainment from stealing, not taking things belonging to others, not even harboring the desire, because the desire will lead to the activity. Person like this, even if he sees wealth on the floor, in India the culture would be not to pick it up because it doesn't belong to you. And then celibacy. They would eat in a way that they wouldn't be disturbed. But this level of meditation, and it's not the only path, but this level of meditation, for this kind of concentration and discernment and that type of thing, people would be completely celibate. And they would. But in general, ultimate self-realization cannot be attained if one is sexually active, because it indicates one is still seeking fulfillment on the sensual level and thus misidentifying with the self. So at least in spiritual life, the sex life would be regulated, at least within a committed relationship, within marriage. Or if someone was more evolved, Krishna children in that way, as a yogi. So, you know, because it would be taking so. Now, it's very important to understand how in Vedic culture you dealt with all kinds of desires. They weren't never repressed. Because things were repressed, you would think of the object more. They never were indulged in. They were generally regulated in a way. And what regulation does, it allows you to satisfy the desire so one doesn't meditate on it. And at the same time, you're purifying yourself by that kind of detachment. Because if something's regulated, it means you're satisfying it in a way that your mind is peaceful, but at the same time, you're controlling it. Most of the time, you're controlling it. So it helps you to evolve the mind. And therefore, generally, in. But, again, if one is dedicated spiritually, at least in the bhakti path, it's not renunciation. So one can have a family, dedicate the family to God. Dedicate that act to producing, you know, spiritual children. And finally, the renunciation of possessions is an ability to see the problems caused by acquisition. Why? When you accumulate things, you get the attachments to them, so that the torment of desires increases. And it creates a lack of empathy for others. If you're just hoarding things and others are so poor, it creates a lack of empathy within the heart. So a spiritual person tries to take what they need, and different people have different needs. I remember she moved to India, but there was this lady on the Upper West Side. And I used to visit her, and she used to come to my classes, and she was from a European family. And she became so committed that practically all her wealth was signed over to charity in the future. Two charities, for education and feeding people. And she was very, very generous, but she was always very well. But that's what she took. What she needed. Different people have different needs. That's a natural need. Usually, especially for a lady, to look nice. It's not against it. Of course, this is yogis. This is a different thing. But in the general principle, you take what you need. What do you need? There's different needs. But you take what you need, not more. Understanding that the goal is not that enjoyment, but it's the change of consciousness, but you need that to be satisfied so that you can pursue that. So no one asks a lady to be renounced from trying to look beautiful. Some people, ladies, do that. They become nuns, they shave heads, they things that, but you can be, it's anyway, there's different paths. But we're going to talk about the path of bhakti. So you take what you need for doing a greater work than what your need is. But if you don't have your eye on the goal, then you simply accumulate things. And you walk down, you know, of course I'm a monk, so I live simply, I don't have many possessions, okay. And whatever that, I could go back to New York City and they just create so many needs for people. They're controlling your minds. I know, I told you, I have a student that's studying advertising. They take these surveys and they find out how to create samskaras or attachments in your mind by putting other attachments in your mind just to create your needs. You know, but okay, you need to look beautiful or what, or dress, or whatever the case is, that's fine. But hoarding wealth without sharing it is sheer selfishness and points to a lack of sympathy and light for others. So you have to be very careful in that regard. And it causes violence. Because you can't really get things these days. You have to be very careful because it's somehow or other taking from someone or exploiting someone. So we try to live in the world in a spiritual way. Okay, we have our needs. Be careful how much you take. Because it's connected in that way. And again, different people have different needs. It's not that a person can't be wealthy, but they have to see. What is my karma? What is my nature? What are my requirements? What are my responsibilities? But be careful. And these yamas are considered the great vow. They are not exempted by one's class, place, time, or set. They are universal. For example, warriors are allowed to hunt. And they're allowed to eat meat. But if you're a yogi, it doesn't matter what class you're born in. You also have to do this. And it's not exempt in any circumstance. It means it's not exempt for a modern world of people wanting to do yoga, yogis. These yamas are non-negotiable. According to Patanjali, there's no exceptions, it says, for any place, circumstance, time. You're born into a family that eats meat? No exceptions. You're a fisherman? No exceptions. You're a yogi? This is what you do. Okay? Because the Gita is a little different. Arjuna is encouraged to fight. We're going to discuss that. Because it's bhakti, it's dedication. So here's your attachments. Purify the consciousness. Develop devotion and love. But a yogi doesn't become a policeman. But a bhakta can become a policeman if he legitimately feels that his service, in Sanskrit, the word for warrior is kshatriya. Kshat means hurt, rayate means to protect. To protect one from hurt. If that's your duty, you do it. But these are different things. It's not by the place. So some people will only abstain from meeting in a sacred place. No, it's and other places, not all places, time, certain calendar occasions, no. Circumstances, Ayurveda, soldiers, no. If you want to be a yogi, you can't be a warrior. That's all.
Seems like it comes down then to satya, the truth.
To what?
It comes down to satya. I mean, because if you say you only do this in one place, then you're not being truthful.
Sure. Yeah, true. Yeah.
Can I ask a question too?
Yeah.
So I've been sitting here thinking about how the Ten Commandments, there's ten and I don't remember what they are, but it sounds like all five cover probably all ten. And so I've been trying to think of different exceptions, and just the only one that I can't quite track to one of the five principles is there are some people, and maybe this is just a basic precept of the whole thing, are lacking in sensitivity or just general intellectual curiosity, and their lack of just awareness may create some harm to others, but
if it comes harm to others, it's going to manifest in one of these.
But in other words, it's not conscious to their behavior. There's no willful intent. So that was just one that struck me as...
Well, it does say that the intent, in terms of karma, obviously the intent of something creates a greater reaction. But it's still, you do... Well, if you're a yogi, okay, then you're reading these things and there's a tradition and you know what to do. Okay? If you're a yogi, then you enter into a path of self-awareness and then you'll be educated. So you'll know them. Okay? The observances... Controlling the mind in relationship to oneself. I guess that would be the rules. And yamas would be the regulations. So, their cleanliness, contentment, austerity, study of the scriptures, and again, Ishvara Pranidani Niyama. Saucha, Santosh, Tapa, Swadhyaya Ishvara Pranidani Niyama. contentment. It's really inside. It's such a deep source that you are happy. Okay, cleanliness. You have to follow it. Because you can't morph your mind to a higher level of discern. You know, the teachers, the people that were cultivating knowledge, they were always cleaning. A lot of them would even cook for themselves just to make sure that what's internally inside is the consciousness of the cook affects the quality of the food. They would cook for themselves. They were always cleaning, the Brahmin. And it creates that mode. So it's there for yoga. You want to cultivate sattva. Cleanliness is so important. And internally what you take and your internal consciousness. Internal cleanliness is to be accomplished by benevolence, exuding a friendly attitude towards all. That's interesting. I left out some important verses in the first thing that I'm going to actually read right now in terms of the yogi and how you kind of can meditate and how you have to be careful to meditate. How to increase, in a day-to-day way, how to increase your lucidity. Remember, the focus is lucidity. Clear conception by a certain mode of mind. So how do you create that certain mode of mind in a day-to-day activity? By cultivating an attitude of friendship towards those who are happy, compassion towards those in distress, joy towards those who are virtuous, and equanimity to those who are non-virtuous. Lucidity arises in the mind.
Page 120.
What? 133. I just wanted to bring that out, but it's interesting. Look, if someone is happy or virtuous and you're not their well-wisher, what will happen? You'll be envious of them. You'll have hate, and the mind, the lucidity of the mind will decrease. But wait, what happens with us? Someone's happy, we become envious. Someone is virtuous, more advanced than us, we become envious. You be their friend, their well-wisher. It's very, very difficult. I remember I took a meditational vow this one time and I went to a holy place. And I meditated on this verse the whole time. It says, Trinada pi sanichena, Dorora pi shuhishnana, Amanina madanena, madanena, kirtaniya siddhari. One should chant the holy name in a humble state of mind. One should think oneself lower than the straw in the street, more tolerant than a tree, devoid of all sense of false prestige, and ready to offer all respects to others. In such a state of mind, one can chant constantly. So in my meditation, I'm chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. So what I did, I meditated on that devoid of all, ready to offer all respects to others. And I remembered that somehow or other, whatever you're doing, there's always sometimes a person that's a competitor. And there's always a person that's kind of your equal, but doing better than you. Envy is so easy. And I saw it was a little bit of a challenge to me. So I remember after every mantra, every round, 108 mantras I chant, it's called the mala around, I would offer the person respect to keep the lucidity of the mind. And the same thing, if you're not compassionate to those who are miserable, at least wishing to remove their miseries, and if you do that, then your hate, your desire to inflict harm on others will be removed. Because if you're satisfied with someone in a suffering condition, then somehow or other you're wishing that for them. It's so practical. There's so much knowledge in these books. And finally, by these traits of envy, desire, by equanimity towards the impious, contamination of tolerance as you move. Because some people are not following as good as you, and if you want to, if you're you have equanimity, then your quality of intolerance will be moved. And it says, if you don't purify yourself of what are these envy, desire to inflict harm, and intolerance, if you don't purify them, they're of Rajas and Tamas, they're of the lower modes of nature. And they will degrade your consciousness. You won't be able to have yoga. So this is so powerful, this stuff. Okay, where was I up to? What verse? Okay. Okay, I'm going to push you now. Because it's getting tired, it's getting late. But I'm determined to cover everything. Okay? And then, of course, again, same thing, austerity, we discussed that. The ability to tolerate the dualities of life, to avoid useless talks, tolerating hardships and difficulties. Be undertaken in the pursuance of your spiritual objective. Not to always adjust. You know, my tradition, you take what you need, but not more. But not, you know, be careful. That's all what it says. This life of just endlessly trying to adjust every environment of the object of the environment to our desires and wills and things. Don't worry. A little discomfort will be healthy for you. And then Swadhyaya refers to reading the sacred scriptures. Again, it's important to get good thoughts. And your taste and inspiration for the spiritual increase, your distaste for those things which are against yoga, that will decrease. And finally, Ishvara Pranidhan. So Patanjali is actually in yoga is requiring a theistic practice to invoke the mercy of God to enable you to achieve something that's really ultimately beyond your own endeavor. And it's, you know, even really have to change the concept. That's why A.G. Mohan said, without Ishvara Pranidhan, without accepting something greater than yourself, it's really going to be hard to overcome the ego. Really hard. And so it's not optional here. And this is changing of the consciousness from this. I am the center. Everything is objects for me. To, in other words, changing your consciousness from being the center to serving the center. Changing your consciousness from working for everything to endorse your senses and your ego to serving something greater than yourself, which is inclusive of others. So you don't change that consciousness. How can you enter into yoga? Okay, now, we discussed this before. Vitarka 33, Hadane Pratipaksha Bhavana. Upon being harassed by negative thoughts, one should counteracting thoughts. It's beautiful. This is where my whole yoga psychology came from. It's understanding everything else. What does that mean? You have hate for someone. It's degrading the mind. Okay? And if you act on it by criticizing them or doing something to them, the hate will increase. And then we see it just becomes consuming. Hatfields, McCoys. It just becomes, you know that? That doesn't work. Okay. It just becomes consuming. Right? So instead of satisfying that, what are negative thoughts? There are things that go against the yamas and niyamas. That's negative thoughts. So counteract them with positive thoughts. With rather than have a negative thought, a hate, let's say ahimsa, I hate. Right? Then have a positive thought. What is the good qualities in the person? Or what will be the result of this hate? So develop an aversion to hate. That's a klishta samskara. Rather than have hate, klishta samskara, a troubling thought that will degrade you, develop a klishta samskara. I hate hate. And what hate will do to consume me. Or like a friend of mine who's a very intense meditator. And his meditation has gone beyond the mind because he's in constant physical pain. He has nerve problems, neuralgia, got them operated twice. He's in terrible pain, but because, at least what I feel in his bhakti, it's not coming from the mind, it's flowing from his soul. His meditation just always increases. And because we're close friends, he reveals it to me. But before he picks up his meditation, which he does for 6 hours every day, for 2 hours, he prays to lines of saints, thinking of good qualities. Then he does something that's very interesting. All the contemporary people that he knows, he prays to. And he divides them into two sections. Those who are vipaksha and those who are svapaksha. Svapaksha means those who are for him and those who are against him. There's always people like this, conservatives and liberals, right? So you even have the church or something like that. There are people that are on your side and against you. People that don't like your liberality. People that don't like your conservativeness. So whatever side, there's people that don't like what he does. Not the same thing. He meditates on their good qualities. He just doesn't allow people, in a very broad-minded and spiritual understanding, understand that they're also great souls. They just have a different political persuasion and view of spiritual life that's maybe more traditional than his, whatever it is. But he looks at all their good qualities. So this type of things, very, very, very powerful, powerful. And what are negative thoughts? They may be personally performed on one's behalf, or authorized by oneself. They may be triggered by greed, anger, or delusion. They may be slight, moderate, extreme. One should cultivate counteracting thoughts. Namely, that the end result of negative thoughts are ongoing suffering and ignorance. Ongoing suffering and ignorance. So one has that thing. If I do this, even if I enjoy it, if I criticize someone, and you know, and the thing is, the more you get into spiritual life, the more you purify your consciousness, then the more significant are the things that you do. It's just like when you have a clear glass of water, little specks of dirt become prominent. Right? But if you have a muddy glass of water, so many things can come in. So when you become a yogi, a spiritualist, and you want to attain a higher and higher level of consciousness, you're more sensitive to these things. And since they're talking to yogis, its relevance to us on one level is even more relevance to them on another level. So the more you actually are fixing your mind up and want to purify yourself, the more careful you are. And here it just says, upon being harassed, which says all these things. Well, in terms of meaning, it's eating the meat or buying the meat, or you know, for yogi would be even sitting at the table, you know, these things like that. They'd be for things like that. Okay. Wow. We're doing pretty good. You promise not to tell anyone? What? We'll finish a little early. We're going to take one more break, and then actually what I'm going to do is I'm going to finish what I think is a thing, then we'll take one more break, and then what I'll do is I'll give a short summary of it. We'll read over the verses, see what we assimilate, and then we'll end with meditation. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And there was one great saint that died. He recently died. And in the place where I am, he became so dedicated to this kirtan of chanting the names that he started a 24-hour kirtan. It means it never ends. And it went on by his grace for 24 years. It's still going on now. For 24 years. And I mean, he was on a very, very high level. From America, actually, but he lived in India. And a lot of the kirtan that you see in the world now, even Ananta and Achyuta, if you see these, they were all influenced by him. Because he used to make these tapes. It's actually his 60th birthday today, so it's nice. His name was Iyengar. And he used to make these tapes, and sometimes in a spiritual tradition, there's a kind of conservativeness. You know, but he brought kirtan out to a whole new perspective. And it inspired, like, the youth all around the world. So then, somehow he died. And it continued to go on, even to this day. And it's unbelievable. You know, Bryn was fortunate to see him, and it blew her mind, actually. The way I met Bryn is someone had met her at the Bhakti Fest that knew me, and somehow she was kind of to go to India, and they contacted me. She maybe told the story, or so maybe the other class. And then I was in my place, and somebody had brought her to me, and then I guided her experience, and she had a very deep bhakti experience in Vrindavan. And then she would come to my classes at 4 o'clock. And in that way, you know, kind of matched. She liked my teachings. And we developed a very close relationship. And then she brought me here to, you know, when this place was opening, as a spiritual mentor, you know, give that kind of philosophical discernment here a little bit. But she sat in those kirtans with this saint, too. She sat in these kirtans, and they were rocking. And you can't believe what those kirtans are like. There's hundreds and thousands of people that are coming in, and they're all dancing. They just dance and dance. And these are not, you know, they're old people, young people, old women, young women. They're all just dancing and dancing and dancing. Dancing. And the kirtan goes on. It goes on through the night. It doesn't stop. But after he established it, and then he had enough people, he used to come at the main time at about 6 o'clock. There's the main arti, and the whole community would come, and they would wait for him to come down to his arti, his kirtans. So it was his 60th birthday, and he had a close friend. And it was a close friend, but it was also, the friend considered him like his guru. And then when he died, the friend was heartbroken. They were both monks. He was heartbroken. He couldn't live his life without him. That's how much he had a relationship he was getting. And it was just heartbroken and heartbroken. You know, And the person himself was kind of like a little otherworldly. You know what I'm saying? It wouldn't be the person, you know, that, you know, you take home for dinner or something. You know, it was a little bit otherworldly. But he didn't know what to do with all this separation. So what he said is, I'll come to New York, where I'm from, and I'll do kirtan every day for 4 hours. So for the last year, every day, he goes out and does kirtan. Every single day. And then there's a community of people that just join him. It's a little funky sometimes, you know? But sometimes some of the best kirtaners come or no one comes. But it's really far out. And you know, one person that comes every day there and does kirtan? Nadi.
Did they do it in the summer recently? Would that be the...
It's the winter. He said he'll do it. So you can't do it outside. So he goes in the subway. He goes to Union Square. So sometimes it's real funky. Sometimes they get great musicians. Sometimes a little, you know, you don't know what's going to be out there. But he's done it and done it. By seeing from that kind of thing, the involvement in this person's consciousness. He's not young either. Recently he came up where I stay, 2 hours north of New York City. And he came up there to stay. Of course, Estefany is another monk. He did it in a state of exhaustion for 1 year. But it was amazing. So on the 60th birthday, I guess they're going to have kirtan in Union Square. So when we're finished here, anybody wants to walk with me, I'm going to walk over there and see what's going on. I am not here because she probably won't be able to come. But I come there sometimes. I can't come often. I see Nadi is doing the kirtan there. It's here. Okay. No, let's see. In the present, okay, what's going to be explained now. Okay, wow. You know what I'll do? We'll finish up, take a break, come back, and have a little ending. I think I can do it for 5 or 10 minutes, okay? Now, if you perfect any of these, there's boons that you get. So, in the presence of one who's established nonviolence, enmity is abandoned. You don't know the effect of karma. Because the mind is created as the same substance as matter. When one develops his mind in an evolved way, it has incredible influence on the people around him. Incredible influence on the people around him. So, very powerful. So, it says, this sattvic mind, it can pervade out, affect the minds of others, and counter the ignorance and the passion in those other minds, and stimulate that sattvic potential. It says even a cobra and a mongoose could not fight. And in each tradition, the Catholic, St. Francis, in our tradition, Chaitanya, very, very powerful. The mind has an influence because it's the same matter as your body and your mind. So there are vibrations of that kind of sattvic mind. And therefore, in spiritual life, the most important thing is sadhu sangha, sat sangha, to join or associate with those who have a higher mind. Because it will influence you. That's the most powerful thing, is the environment, the time of day, the food. The most powerful thing is the people. So, if you're establishing truthfulness, one assures the fruition of your actions. So if you're truthful, whatever you do will bear fruit. And this is not truthful. These things... they're the perfection of these things. And they have to do with really no ill desire, no coveting, no... Why? When you're truthful, people will listen to one's authority. You won't have to push people. But if people see you have integrity and that you are going to align your words with your values, it has a tremendous effect on people. When one is established and refraining from stealing, all jewels manifest. Why? When one is detached, people are eager to bestow the best things to them, knowing that they'll use it in a good service. So it's a fact. If someone becomes very, very detached, people want to give them the best things, because they know that they'll be used in a good way. Just like in Vrindavan, we have this one charity called Food for Life. A friend of mine, this very saintly Italian man, has this charity. And it's amazing. When people come on the yoga groups or come, we take them there, their minds are blown when they see this school, where they take the poorest of the poor and give them the best care and education. And you see they're like jewels of happiness. And you go to the morning ceremony, there's 1,000 people. And what they do, it kind of starts up slow, then all of a sudden there's kirtan. By 1,000 of these kids in circles, and they grab your hands and put you in the circles. But this person, you know, he would sleep in his office on the top of his desk. You know, for a charity, it's less than a half of 1% is used for the maintenance of the people involved in it. It's like, you know, and people know that he's so detached, and therefore so many people give him donations and money. So it's something like that. If you really, really refrain from stealing and don't covet from other people, there's such a great trust that will come to you. Upon the establishment of celibacy, power is attained. So that's the great vow, actually, because that's one of the most powerful samskaras, which is sex desire. So one can get powers, mystic powers, by celibacy. And even in Ayurveda, the subtle vital energies that form the essence of all tissues and the prana. And it's the essential agreement of vigor and potency. And when that is dissipated, it's in the semen, when it's dissipated by excessive activity, the body and immune system are deprived of this. And that's celibacy, not repression, but someone who's actually, the desires have been reduced, and they can control in that way. So there's great power in that. And one of the examples was Mahatma Gandhi, what he was able to do. When refraining from covetousness becomes firmly established, knowledge of the whys and wherefores of births manifest. So why does that happen? Because in a clean lake you can see something. So when you're free from that kind of covetousness and you know, like that, and your conscience is not directed outward by wanting things, and it's directed inward, you can actually, when your conscience becomes clear, the yogi who perfects this, he can actually see the samskaras in his consciousness, which are from previous lives. So you can understand, even when I went to this Alabama recently, I told the story, and that young boy was sitting there. You know, I could look at him and understand that this was an evolved soul. Somehow he was born to such a good mother and such a good father, and he was so balanced with him. I could understand. And one can understand themselves. I could see his samskaras. I'm not saying mystic powers, just obvious. This is not from this life. But one can see himself and understand that. By cleanliness, one develops distaste for one's body and the cessation of contact with others. That's considered a move in yoga. Why? Because what happens is by cleanliness, you see what the body really is if you're that meditative, right? Why are you cleaning? Because what's the body? So many disgusting things are constantly coming out of it. So when someone cleans, and then you realize what else you're embracing. And it's very subtle. Even when one sits on an asana, generally, you won't sit on another person's seat when you're meditating. Because the subtleties of his consciousness will be there. So one develops a tremendous... And this is also, you become sensitive to others' desires. So for a yogi, for one who actually wants to meditate on this level without the consciousness being externalized, this is a great boon. You actually lose the desire. Someone had a question? Okay. Upon the purification of the mind, one attains cheerfulness, one pointedness, sense control, and fitness to perceive the self. From austerity, on account of the movement of purities, the perfection of the senses and body manifest, first the mystic powers. True yogi, he doesn't want these, but they come. Finally, from study of the scriptures, swadhyaya, a connection with one's deity and one's choices manifest. So what happens is, when you perfect study of the sacred texts, then the texts generally point to a form of God with you have a loving relationship, becomes your desired Lord, and it manifests in your heart. And that's considered the perfection of your life. You actually have a personal relationship with the divine. Okay, what we will do now, and I'm such a nice person in this way, we went for an hour. You want to just pull on and finish it all up?
We don't really have that much, so yeah.
No. Well, I will say some concluding words and we'll have some kirtan. Okay, should we push on?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, we don't need a break here? Okay. But let's push on. You know what we'll do right now? Sit up, we're going to do this pranayama. Okay? Just to purify the consciousness. Okay? Sit like this. Put your arms back as far as you can go. And what you're going to do is when you breathe in, you're going to reach for the sky. And then you're going to exhale and let it, like, and make, close your fists like you're pulling something down and go. Okay, I'm going to do it 20 times, okay? Above your navel like this. Just relax. You're just going to let all thoughts go and you can just concentrate on your breath. And together we'll say the mantra Om. Before we say it, it's the perfect mantra. It represents Ishvara, a very generic conception of the divine. It begins from the bottom and goes all the way up to purify the brain. So we'll chant a few Om. Om. concentrate on your breath. And don't follow your thoughts. Relax your shoulders. Okay, you can all look up.